This is the Orange Podcast, conversations with Orange City Council for the local community.
As the leaves start to turn, you've tuned in to the Orange Podcast as we find out more about the stories behind the headlines at Orange City Council. This is Alan Reader. The community of Orange loves a good story. But this week in town, there were two examples of two very different stories told in two very different ways. In the lead up to Anzac Day, a string of street banners tell the stories of commitment, sacrifice and serious damage to a community.
The hurt, the pain and the anguish from families that lose people in the service of our country never leaves. That's the importance of this project. It's about the community coming together to support those families and to recognise the service of their family members and to thank them for that.
More from the Assistant Minister for Veterans Affairs, Matt Thistlethwaite, later in the show. But first, the next chapter in an ongoing story of how the community of Orange comes to grips with sometimes controversial public art played out this week, when the last two of 10 artworks created as part of the Future City Public Art Programme were launched. Over the last 4 years, there's been murals, sculptures and installations. All have attracted a range of community reactions, from anger to bliss. This week, two new works were launched. Dancing with Bees is a two-screen video work perched high over the entrance to the Civic Theatre, which tells the stories of a dozen species of mostly native bees, told through the movements of intricately moving dancers. Then there's Aperture, which has transformed a formerly graffiti-covered local laneway from an underground car park to the main street. Associate Professor Felicity Fenner from the University of New South Wales was part of the panel that helped choose the 11 artists who'd be part of the Future City Public Art Project. Instead of placing art in the silence of a gallery, she admits placing art out in the open air next to the traffic can be tough.
Look, it's challenging, isn't it? You can hear just by all the noise that's going on around us at the moment. It's very different from art in a museum, but that's the whole thing of public art. It's embedded into the urban fabric and it becomes part of the psyche of a place.
Tonight you talked about the contrast between a bit of art, a sculpture being plonked on somewhere and something that's a bit more, it's emerged from the locals.
Yes.
Where does these two art fits into that spectrum?
Well, I think if it's emerged as a sort of grassroots initiative, it's going to be a lot more successful because the artworks, for example, in the current Orange Public Art Programme of 10 permanent pieces, they've all the artists travelled here, they met with local community, they got to know the city and the ins and outs, the nooks and crannies, and so the works have really grown out of the place and of the people. So they really belong to the place and the people, and I think people will be able to identify with them, and it really fosters an amazing sense of belonging and of community. Love it or hate it, you still have that sense of ownership and community.
Is it unusual for public art to provoke controversy?
No, it's the norm. Everyone loves to hate public art. You often get people saying, well, why aren't we spending money on roundabouts and hospitals and footy stadiums? And I think roundabouts and hospitals and footy stadiums especially are really, really important things to spend local government money on, and this one's also funded by the state government. But they're not legacy giving. You know, when you travel overseas, you go to a foreign city, the first thing you do is go to the museums and you look at the art around the city. You don't go to look at the roundabouts. So I just think in terms of legacy building, of saying this was us, this is who we were, public art often outlives the people that make it, and for that reason it's very important.
You mentioned also tonight that there's a pattern of a bit of artwork starting off is very controversial, lots of opposition from the residents, and then that tends to swing around.
Yeah, look, you know, the Eiffel Tower was erected as a temporary artwork to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution, 1889, and it was hated. It was a big tower on the Parisian landscape, and some of the most vociferous opponents to the Eiffel Tower would go and have lunch in the restaurant at its base every day just so they didn't have to look at it. But then people grew to love it. Anthony Gormley's work, Angel of the North in Northern England, same thing. People hated it. There was a lot of objection to that. Now people love it. It's iconic. So you've just got to give it time.
What's your advice to a council that's taking on that sort of opposition? Is it just practice? Do you try to turn it around by changing people's minds, or just leave some room for people to get used to it?
I think let people get used to it. I don't think art should be treated any differently to any other sort of infrastructure for the city. It's just as important, as I said, sometimes even more important in terms of legacy. Unfortunately, with government funding, art and culture are often the first things to be cut when there are cuts, so that's very short-sighted, in my opinion, because you're really denying your residents that sort of sense of community and belonging.
Dancing with Bees creator Zanny Begg always wanted to make an artwork that was grounded in local themes.
Definitely. I think it's a lot of responsibility to make a public artwork, and you want to make something that really connects to the community as much as you can. Obviously, you can't please everyone, but as far as you can. So for me, I was really interested in Orange being an agricultural area, a food basin. It's very famous for its food culture. And so I was kind of winding that back in my mind and saying, well, what's central to that? And it's pollination, obviously. That's at the core of everything we eat, is the pollination process. So, you know, there's the European honeybees that we're familiar with, but then there are all these native bees who also play their role in that complex ecosystem. So I thought that would be a really nice way to kind of be a starting point to make the work and to connect it to, you know, some of the stuff that Orange is most famous for. But then moving beyond that, it was like, well, how do we kind of make a work that's about that, that really is specific to here? So going to the DPI offices and making those images from the collection, which is based in Orange, was really an important part of the work. And then bees talk to each other by dancing. So then to cast local dancers to be the second face of the clock. So I feel all those threads come together to something that I really hope is of and by and for Orange, you know.
Does that give the work some longevity? Can you see that still being interesting for the community in 5 or 10 years' time, or even longer?
I hope so. I think a clock is about time, obviously. And, you know, from some of the native bees are on the endangered list because of land clearing, because of the bushfires. You know, they are under threat. Also, honeybees, there's the varroa mite, and that's had a big impact on agriculture globally and is now here in Australia. So all these factors, I think, won't go away. And so when we are thinking about time and, you know, because of climate change, sometimes we think about running out of time. So I think that that conversation, I hope, stays live and that this work stays relevant. And it helps us think about things like how we imagine time from a seasonal and environmental point of view, as well as this sort of utilitarian trade-based Eastern Standard Time, which is what a clock does. It actually does keep perfect time. So, you know, you could use it as a clock, but you might have to talk about meeting at Blue Banded Bee o'clock rather than 8 o'clock, you know, and maybe that's a nice conversation to have.
Often when an artist is creating something, they're heading for a gallery. They're heading for a nice, confined, quiet space. This is public art where people are going to walk through and interrupt and be surprised by it. Is that part of... How did you keep that in mind as you work on the work?
Yeah, 100%. One of the things, the clock is silent because it is a public artwork, and I didn't want to have something that was kind of annoying. I think I want people to discover it as a visual joy, and they can spend as long with it as they want. Like, it might be that they spend 2 seconds. Well, some people are saying they end up watching it for an hour. You know, you don't really watch a kettle boil, you don't watch a clock pass, but in this case, some people are, and that's beautiful, you know, but it's like, it's very much driven by the viewer. They can spend as long or as little with this as they want to, and I want it to be like that. So that's why it's a silent and it just sits there, and you know, it looks different at night, it looks different at the day, it changes all the time. You can drop back and find something new. Hopefully over a long period of time you'll still be discovering something new, because it's 24 hours. It's a lot of time to know everything that happens in there, and I've got little surprises that happen across the clock at different points that people can discover. I hope there is that sense of it growing with the city over time.
Councillor Mel McDonald, we're here in a very public place at the side of a car park with lots of noise around it. Why is there art here?
Well, there's art here because we had this space that really needed reinvigorating, really. It was this perfect opportunity to create something light and a real conversation piece, somewhere that you actually wanted to spend time rather than actually trying to get from the beginning of the laneway straight through to the end and get out of that horrible, dank space. Now it's this light, bright, engaging space. It's beautiful.
There's a view that the council should just be about roads and roundabouts and rubbish. Can the council do half as well?
Absolutely. The council has to do more than that because a community is more than just roads and rubbish. So the council's job is to provide, you know, a community that we can all live in and all enjoy.
How do you sell that to the community?
Look, there's always going to be people who don't agree with things that council does. You're never going to get everyone agreeing on anything in life. So at the end of the day, we make decisions based on what we believe is the best thing for our community going forward. And as long as, look, that's how we make our decisions, and I think we're going to have a fantastic city now and into the future.
You saw some places last night as people saw this for the first time. What do you see? Do you think it's something that people are going to embrace and get used to very quickly?
Absolutely. It's certainly going to be a talking point. It's certainly already starting a bit of online commenting, I suppose. But no, it's definitely something that's going to really change the way we view our city, as well as how we act in these spaces as well. There can be a real resistance to any kind of change, anything new, and it's that's unknown element. But once we get used to it, once we actually see what things are like in real life, in day-to-day life, it can just become part of our existence. And if you think about taking it away, it suddenly invokes that sort of protective reaction of, no, this is part of our city now.
Orange City Councillor Mel McDonald. Around the time of the Second World War, four brothers from Orange, men of ability and promise, raised on a local orchard, went off to war. The fact that only two of those four came back is one way of calculating the damage. The fact that a son of one of those who returned went on to serve as a local Member of Parliament and as a Cabinet Member is another way of saying, what if all four had gone on to live normal lives on the farm? It was an idea on the mind of former Orange MP Gary West at the launch of the Local Fallen Banner Project.
Both uncles, one younger than my father and one older than my father, in a family of Wests where four went to the Second World War and only two came back. It's tremendous that Orange City Council and the sub-branch here have been able to recognise and honour those that didn't come back. For a long time, we've seen marches here in Orange where we've honoured and applauded those who fought for us but came back. We haven't had this opportunity to pay tribute to those who didn't.
It points to the sheer scale of the damage left in an Orange community where two uncles don't come back and one does. The progeny of that one goes on to serve the state government.
Well, I was privileged to be in that position. In fact, I also went through the Air Training Corps here in Orange as a cadet and then eventually got my commission. Although I never served in the theatre of war, I was lucky to join the General Reserve and get a commission in the Royal Australian Air Force.
But a huge amount of damage to one family, and there are 40 here.
Oh, the families across the world have suffered from war, and I just hope that we don't see it again.
That's the other side of the coin. It's good to honour the veterans. It's important to work hard to prevent it ever happening.
That's exactly what we've got to aim to do, is to say, let's have an argument if we have to, but there is a better way of settling it than actually having to kill people.
In the lead-up to Anzac Day, street banners were erected this week along Summer Street. The list of soldiers from Orange who've died in war is too long to hang banners for each in just the 1 year. The local RSL sub-branch has put together the list, which stretches past 200. Sub-branch President Chris Colvin.
I just think as we look at the photos, and these were all young men, and the ode says, the first line says, they shall grow not old, as we the left grow old. And this is so true of tonight. This, what we're seeing today and these banners, will show that these were young men at the time they gave their ultimate sacrifice. I just feel in awe of being around them to see the photos.
It also points to the huge amount of damage that these deaths caused to the Orange community.
Oh, we lost over 240 men between the Sudan right up until the present time. And I don't want to lose any more, but yeah, unfortunately, that's the names on our honour roll. It's 240-odd, and we can go from there, yeah.
Are you pleased the council's taking this?
Oh, this is absolutely fantastic. The council's initiative, the support we've had from the council, we made sure it was correct. Everything, all the names and information were the best we could get, and the photos are the best, so the team that worked on getting it right did it well.
Chris Colvin. The Federal Assistant Minister for Veterans Affairs, Matt Thistlethwaite, had the Colvin family in mind on the night of the launch, telling the story of men who'd worked in a local Dalton Brothers store before going off to fight.
Yeah, the Colvin family paid a particularly high sacrifice, with two of their sons paying the ultimate sacrifice in World War I. And when I read that story, I thought, given that that was being brought to life through these banners, that that was an important story to tell. And it's a reminder of their service, but it also brings to life that service in the local community here, so that my generation and future generations to come can really understand just how much not only those service men and women paid the ultimate price, but their families for generations to come as well.
We heard from Gary West at the end there, yeah. a former state minister who was bookended by two uncles that didn't come back. That again, talks to the damage on the whole of Australian community, particularly Orange.
Yeah, Gary spoke with great passion, and I think you could see in his voice that the hurt, the pain and the anguish from families that lose people in the service of our country never leaves. And that was World War II service for his family. And, you know, they never forget that. And that's the importance of this project. It's about the community coming together to support those families and to recognise the service of their family members and to thank them for that.
It's hard to do when you've got a population of 26 million. Is it a bit easier to get that message across when you've got a regional city and people can recognise local surnames?
Yeah, look, in every town and city that I go to across the country, there's always a memorial and a cenotaph, and so there should be. But I think we can probably do more to bring to life the stories of people who've served our nation, particularly around Anzac Day and Remembrance Day, and this project does that. And for the 20-odd days leading up to Anzac Day, those faces, those names and those stories will be displayed on the main streets of Orange here, and my generation and younger generations can learn the service and sacrifice of those who've come before us and really comprehend that the freedom that we all enjoy today didn't come for nothing. It came at the service of those who've gone before us, and it's our duty to remember that and to pay tribute to that, and that's what this project is all about.
Is this a good way of getting a message across? Would you expect other regional cities to try a similar model?
Yeah, I think it would be a great model that we should be looking at rolling out across Australia. I know I'm going to go back to the community that I live in and recommend to the local council that they think about doing this next year. And I'll also go back to Canberra and see if we can't amend some of the terms of the Saluting Their Service program to incorporate funding for projects such as this, because I think that they're really important.
Was it good to meet with actual family members tonight?
Yeah, it's really made the visit so special. And I'm fortunate that I was able to highlight some of those stories and tell those stories tonight, but to meet the families and to see how much the service of their relatives means to them and how proud they are of that, and to be able to recognise that as a city and as a community, I think is really important. So this has been a really touching night for me.
Assistant Minister for Veterans Affairs, Matt Thistlethwaite. And that's the Orange Podcast for this week. Remember, you can leave a review of this program wherever you get your podcasts. That can help someone else find this show. The Orange Podcast is produced on Wiradjuri Country. Until next time, this is Alan Reader. Bye for now.